Welcome back to the Damage Report, everybody. I'm John Derulo. Burke is here.
I am.
No JR.
No JR.
Turns out JR is sick.
And it's fine. It's Beyonce Wednesdays anyway, so.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
It just makes sense that you have our two biggest fans.
That's true.
Sitting here
together.
We'll
see who's the bigger one.
Exactly, so.
But yeah, we apologize about JR. He is sick because he chose to have a kid. And so you're just sick for like 20 years.
Wait, they just pass it around the house.
Yeah, nonstop. But yeah, it is Beyonce Wednesdays. Beyonce was in the Time Top 100 nominating Michelle Obama.
Beyonce's
pretty awesome.
Homecoming came out early this morning.
I think everybody already knows that,
album.
Obviously.
There's a new album. Well, it's like new old. But you know, if you watch that, Coachella said it's like a lot of the live band. And so you get all of that action. And it's good. It's what you need in your
life. Can I ask you, do you believe that I've seen any of it?
Yes.
Did I? Yeah, I probably did. I don't know. I don't remember, but I'm sure it was good.
You went to a Beyonce concert.
I did. That was cool. Yeah. Okay, so there's Beyonce today. There's other stuff too, though, which we're going to talk about. Roy Moore back on political radar. For some reason, we live in a nightmare land. That's where we live. But we've got other stuff too. So I do want to talk a little bit about the Time 100 most influential people, because there were some entries that I found inspirational and some that were just, they make you want to go back to bed, basically. Like, nope, I guess I've had enough of the news today. And so we'll be breaking down one of those. Tucker Carlson's going to totally creep you out. And we've also got a couple of great guests. We're going to be talking with a climate activist a little bit later on about one of their efforts to help reduce emissions. And we've also got a big update on some new information coming from the war on Yemen. Information about Saudi Arabia, the US, and France as well. So very interesting stuff there. We'll be joined by a reporter from The Intercept in just a little bit. But first, we turn to Bernie Sanders. Just a couple of days ago, Bernie Sanders had his big town hall on Fox News. It is already having an effect. We said yesterday that several other Democrats now want to do town halls on Fox News as well. And in fact, the first has been announced. Fox News is apparently going to be doing one with Amy Klobuchar. Yay. It's exciting times. It might not be as exciting as the Bernie Sanders one, but there are a lot of people still fired up over the Bernie one, including Donald Trump. No fan of Bernie Sanders. He's been tweeting since the town hall about Bernie.
It's a lot of tweets.
Yeah, let's start from the initial one.
Okay.
So weird to watch crazy Bernie on Fox News. Not surprisingly, Brett Baer in the audience was so smiley and nice. Very strange. And now we have Donna Brazile. So look, there's a lot there. I don't know why that other guy's saying it. So
that's funny though.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know why I was there. But it is funny. So he says we talking about Fox News, which many people have noted is sort of a weird way to talk about that. He's sticking with crazy Bernie. He hasn't workshopped anything better yet. And then there's the weird, like I kind of, every once in a while I feel a little bit bad for Donald Trump fans.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very hard to follow what exactly he means. So he's saying Brett Baer and the audience were very smiley and nice, very strange. But before that he says not surprisingly. So was it not surprising or was it very strange? I don't know, like he wants to have his dementia and eat it too. Like it's very hard to follow his tweets sometimes.
Right, I think.
But he is bothered by the fact that Bernie Sanders was received so well on what should be for him day to day state TV.
And then it ends with, and now we have a black? That's kind of what that felt like. What is that?
So he's confused. He's worried about loyalty. That's what he's worried about. But there were other tweets as well. He said, many Trump fans and signs were outside of the Fox News studio last night in the now thriving, thank you, President Trump, he said to himself, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, for the interview with crazy Bernie Sanders. Big complaints about not being let in, stuffed with Bernie supporters. What's with Fox News? And is it true? Like, I don't even, is it true? Were there people waiting outside? Were they not letting in Fox? Like, we're supposed to believe that Fox News saw fans of the president and they said no to them?
Right, honestly, this is strategy, because what this does is allows his fans to say, and his supporters to say, see, when everybody surprisingly agreed with Bernie Sanders, that's because they were all plants.
Yeah.
Because that night, that one night, in just that one moment, Fox News was working against us.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So
yeah.
It wasn't because Bernie's popular.
Mm-hmm.
It's because all of those people in there were Bernie plants.
Exactly. And he goes on, he's really on this thing with Bernie Sanders. I believe it will be crazy Bernie Sanders and sleepy Joe Biden as the two finalists to run against. Maybe the best economy in the history of our country and many other great things I look forward to facing whoever it may be. May God rest their soul, which is of course what you say about someone who's died, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't you talk about that way about somebody who's died?
Yeah.
And like he's coming off of like multiple incitements to political violence, so I'd prefer if he wouldn't talk like that. But as Edwin pointed out, sleepy Joe Biden. Now he has previously used sleepy eyes to describe Chuck Todd, I think, and that's a fairly well-established anti-Semitic trope. That he just likes to throw around. Joe Biden is not Jewish, as far as I know.
I'm going to give this one to him because we have caught Joe Biden sleeping a few times.
Really?
Or appearing to.
I don't remember anything about Joe Biden being sleepy looking.
Like asleep.
You could say creepy Joe Biden. I'd get that. Like I don't get the
asleep.
Sleepy.
I think I've seen it.
I don't remember
okay,
that.
Okay, now I have to look it up. Now I have to look it up.
Control room?
Nobody
sleepy Joe
that?
Biden? I don't know what he's talking about anymore.
Nobody remembers it.
Okay, I think maybe he's just hoping that low energy will keep working for him. But anyway, the important thing is that he goes on more about Bernie Sanders, saying Bernie Sanders and wife should pay the pre-Trump taxes on their almost 600,000 income. He is always complaining about these big tax cuts, except when it benefits him. They made a fortune off of Trump, but so did everyone else, and that's a good thing, not a bad thing. So no, he's complaining about the tax cuts, even though they benefited him. That is to his credit because he is ideologically and intellectually honest and consistent. And he wants to reverse them, even though it would harm him and his wife's income. And everyone made a fortune off of Trump. You know, I saw a story, I meant to include it today. Do you know the average bonus in 2018 versus 2017 for employees? He said they're gonna be big bonuses because all this money's gonna go to these corporations. And in fact, the bonuses did go up. On average, do you know how much they went up from 2017 to 2018 after the tax cuts?
How much?
1 cent.
Oh, of course.
I don't even know how that's possible if they only went up 1 cent,
right.
But that was the analysis that I saw. And everyone, okay. So look, what's important here is that Bernie Sanders has very much been on Donald Trump's mind recently. He can't stop thinking about him. Bernie Sanders also noted this, saying, "Looks like President Trump is scared of our campaign. He should be." I like that. Now, Bernie Sanders is never going to dive Scrooge McDuckian into the muck. Like, he's never going to throw insults the same way that Donald Trump does. But I like that that Bernie Sanders acknowledges that he has really gotten under Donald's skin.
He just like sat back and let him own himself. Like, this is hate. This is a lot. Why are you so obsessed with me? That's what he should have tweeted.
Why are you so obsessed with me? I don't think but Hillary said that. I don't think he wants to say the same thing as Hillary. But yeah, I mean, Donald Trump really does just sit around watching golf and tweeting. And like Bernie did attack Donald Trump. Let's see, called him a pathological liar. He said his tax cuts were a disaster and all that. He did attack him.
Well, calling a liar isn't an attack, to be fair.
Oh, from the liar's point of view, it's probably an attack.
Oh, okay.
But it's not like the town hall was about Donald Trump or that Donald Trump even came up very often. I don't know. We did our coverage of it where we responded to like 13 clips. I don't think Donald Trump was mentioned in any of them. But even that, just Bernie Sanders describing his platform and advocating for it is enough to get under Donald Trump's skin to this extent. I wonder if Bernie is the nominee, I don't know how Donald Trump is gonna survive it. I think he might go crazy.
You think so?
We'll see. Yeah, because it's a different dynamic than Hillary Clinton, but perhaps we'll get the chance to see.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we transition to Fox News. Since the Fox News town hall, Fox News has gone back to just attacking Bernie Sanders nonstop. Both on the opinion side and on the news side, it has been anti-Bernie back and forth. But in discussing Bernie Sanders, one of their commentators, Lisa Booth, did reveal part of why Fox appears to be scared about a Bernie Sanders nomination, and she'll describe it here.
So the danger of Bernie Sanders and his movement is that a lot of these policies on their face are popular with the American people. And that's what makes them so dangerous because of the economic toll they would take on this country. So President Trump's best saving grace is to have a strong economy to say, look, we don't want anyone taking us in a different direction. We're on the right path. The economy is strong. It's booming. People are doing better. That's President Trump's best saving grace against these types of policies. After he announced, he talked to boasted the fact that he had a million people sign up to volunteer for his campaign in every congressional district around the country. What if their candidate is doing that?
Yeah, so the two things there, bookending these comments by Lisa Booth, is his policies are popular and he's generated a huge amount of volunteer support and donations. And he in fact did raise the most money in this first quarter. So look, obviously they don't like the policies. They don't think that they would be good or whatever. But they are admitting there that it is going to be a little bit more difficult to attack him when he has this popular sort of upwelling of support and his policies, even though they are trying to undercut support for them as much as they can, remain popular.
Yeah, that was just kind of like a weird thing to even admit to. Bernie Sanders is dangerous to us because most of America that doesn't have the luxury of living like us, he wants good for them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would say even the middle where she switches back to, and here is how Donald Trump is going to win. He's going to describe how good the economy is, and that is like a defense against the appeal of Bernie Sanders. But the issue there is that Lisa Booth and the other anchors and commentators and all that at Fox News, they don't exist in the economy. They exist in the top level investors only view of the economy. Like, how is the stock market doing or whatever? And you know, you look at huge macroeconomic numbers and you might think, oh, well, you know, unemployment is down. That's good. Okay, that might help a little bit. But for the most part, how Wall Street is doing has no bearing on what regular people think about the economy. And so they might be getting lulled into a false sense of security because regular people don't feel like the economy is doing great for them. They don't feel like, yes, maybe they got a job, but it's not the job that they want. They don't feel like their income is going up. They suffer under a great deal of debt. So I worry a little bit about how shocked, sort of the whiplash that they might experience when their beliefs about the economy run up against what real people think about the economy. But anyway, good news there for Bernie Sanders, I would say, based on the apparent fears of Fox News. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, update on the conflict in Yemen, new leaked information. We're gonna be breaking that down after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Thanks to a new release of information, we have a bit more details of what's actually going on in the Saudi-led war on Yemen. And joining us now to break down that new information is reporter for The Intercept, Alex Emmons. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So first of all, this new information, how was it acquired? And what was your initial impressions after you'd been exposed to it?
Well, I'm not going to get into how it was acquired, but essentially it's a secret intelligence report from the French Directorate of Military Intelligence that shows that the French government has not fully been honest with its people about how its weapons are being used in Yemen. But more importantly, it just demonstrates that the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen is entirely dependent on arms sales for what it's doing. You know, we talk a lot about the transfer of munitions and bombs from the U.S. and other countries, but you know, we're talking about their entire aircraft supply, helicopters, planes comes from the U.S. and Europe. You know, all their tanks comes from the U.S. and Europe. All their warships, for the most part, come from Western countries. So it's a military capability that comes entirely from decades of careless arms sales.
So there's a lot that I want to get into, but that is very interesting because a few months ago, when Jamal Khashoggi had been murdered, there was pressure on the U.S. to stop selling arms to Saudi Arabia. And Donald Trump at the time said, they're going to get the weapons from somewhere. We might as well, you know, make that money. But apparently it's not as easy as all that, that they couldn't simply switch over to buying, you know, bombs and missiles and things like that from China, correct?
Yeah, and here's the reason. It's the modern weapon systems are very dependent on computers and communication systems. So you can't just take a NATO-produced aircraft and stick a Russian bomb on it. It doesn't really work that way when you're dealing with precision-guided munitions. When you sell an F-15 to the Saudi-led coalition, they're dependent on Americans for spare parts, on American communication systems, on American munitions. So it's not like you can just quickly go over to the Russians or Chinese for more bombs. It takes decades to build an air force, and that's come from the West.
You know, it's interesting. Perhaps this goes a little bit beyond the bounds of the new information that we've been exposed to, but based on what you've said about their need for us to rearm them in terms of munitions and spare parts and all of that, the training to use these weapons as well, Trump was acting as if we're sort of beholden to Saudi Arabia, that we need to get this money before someone else gets it. But hypothetically, since they're dependent on us for, you know, re-equipping and retooling and all of that, it seems like we hypothetically actually have quite a bit of leverage over them if they want to continue to be able to use their military. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Yeah, absolutely. Without our support, their air force is grounded. And it's been that way since the beginning of the war. It's been a very powerful source of leverage that multiple administrations, Democratic and Republican, have been unwilling to pull.
And there was also there was some information about, I guess, the French view of how effective the Saudi war effort in Yemen had been. How did they characterize the Saudi efforts?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually not something that's super secret, right? We've had 4 years of this war, and the front lines have barely shifted at all. Maybe up the western coast a little bit, but the Saudis and the Saudi-led coalition have not made significant military progress on Houthi strongholds in the north. All that's really been accomplished in this war is a massive humanitarian crisis that's enriched both sides of the war, but it's been terrible for the Yemeni people.
Yeah,
you can read more about that in the report, but essentially, you know, they're not making progress, and there's a huge price to be paid for the Yemeni people.
And I'm also curious, to what extent do we know, we found out new information about the use of French tanks and artillery and things like that that we previously hadn't known about. The French people, are they largely supportive of this? The new information, I know it's just come out, but is there reason to believe that there might be new pressure on the French government based on what we've learned?
The polling data is really bad, and I suspect that's why the French government has not been fully honest with its people about how the weapons are being used. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, has been one of the foremost defenders of continuing weapon sales to the Saudis, even after Jamal Khashoggi's killing. I mean, Germany suspended arms sales temporarily, so tells you what the attitudes are like in Europe. Mm-hmm. But he's been claiming that French weapons, they don't really have much information indicating that French weapons are being used, that French weapons are being used in a mainly defensive way, that they've never been used against civilians. And all of those lines are kind of dishonest based on what's in the report.
And we have some new, just as of yesterday, I guess, semi-breaking news on the U.S. effort to get out of this war. There was the bipartisan legislation that would have ended our involvement in the Saudi war on Yemen, and that was just vetoed by Donald Trump, his second veto ever. Were you at all surprised that he deployed the veto in this case?
Not surprised at all. And the reason is that that's not only consistent with Trump's unusually close relationship with the Saudis, but it's consistent with decades of American lawyering designed to protect presidential power, right? To take it back one step, you know, the War Powers Resolution was passed in the Vietnam era in reacting to Nixon and Kissinger's secret bombing campaigns of Cambodia and Laos, which were unauthorized. And no president since has really wanted to acknowledge it as constitutional because it would curtail their ability to do things like that, mm-hmm. right? This is the first time it's really been tested in 50 years. And you know, President Trump doesn't want to give ground to congressional oversight. It's certainly something that Trump would do, but it's, you know, something that I think a lot of presidents would do.
And I'm guessing based on the numbers of Republicans in the Senate and the House that initially supported that resolution, it doesn't look like it's likely that Congress will actually be able to override that veto, correct?
No, I don't want to get ahead of that, but I don't think it's quite there.
And so I always want to make sure that when we talk about these issues, we don't get too into the weeds. You've been reporting on Yemen. You've got this new information. What do people that might not be following this story very much, what do they need to know about the current situation in Yemen, the actual humanitarian situation on the ground?
I mean, it's difficult to even describe, right? You've got a country of roughly 30 million people. And, you know, according to the UN, More than 10 million of them are facing possible imminent starvation. It's a country that is heavily dependent on imports for food and medicine, and both the Saudi coalition and the Houthis are slowing the flow of aid and commercial goods into the country. It's a recipe for a horrific humanitarian situation, and that's exactly what's happened. It's a predictable result of the war-fighting strategy that the U.S. is helping to support. It's no surprise. You know, they've got a massive cholera outbreak. It's no surprise because the Saudis bombed wastewater treatment plants. Yeah. And this is the type of behavior the U.S. has been enabling.
Yeah. Well, Alex Emmons, reporter for The Intercept, I want to thank you again for joining us on The Damage Report.
Yeah, happy to be with you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more news to get to. It is admittedly a little bit weird how quickly the media has taken up Pete Buttigieg and hoisted him onto their shoulders, and they just have fallen in love with him. That is true, how quickly that switch has turned. But there is something weirder, and that is Tucker Carlson's reaction to the media liking Pete Buttigieg in the way that they do, as will be demonstrated in this clip.
And there he was yesterday, front and center, now third in the polls, with a speech that many have said are historic.
He's inspirational so far, and that's something that voters absolutely want.
He has this appeal for a lot of reasons. He is a veteran. He is openly gay. He is from Indiana. He is honest. He speaks from the heart. He seems like he's a lot about empathy here.
You are a concert pianist. Yeah. You speak many languages, including Norwegian, that you learned because you wanted to read a book. A real Renaissance man.
He's like Beto's smarter brother a little bit. And he's so smart to try to channel Obama.
The second coming of Obama, huh? We'll see about that. My prayers may have been answered if that's true.
The draw to this point has been young, fresh, positive, and a change agent.
This guy is chicken soup for my soul.
Chicken soup for my soul. Even by the naughty standards of the news media, this is a new level of political commitment. They don't just want to vote for this guy. They want to consume him like a hearty stew. Every last drop of Buttigieg, yum. They're all in. What's going on here exactly? Who is this guy?
Seriously, what is going on here? What was that?
Right, that was just thinking that as soon as he said that. No, answer it yourself. What in the world was that they want to consume him?
And the look on his face, I... Look.
Also, chicken soup for the soul doesn't actually mean you want to eat somebody. That's
no?
For the soul part, Tucker.
Okay, so look, I get that writing... comedy in a news context is difficult, okay? That was weird.
That was so weird, yeah.
Like, that made me feel like I've almost experienced being alone in an elevator with Joe Biden. Like, I think I know what that feels like now. Anyway, super creepy. And the thing is, like, yes, the media's being weird. As we pointed out, like, stuff about the piano and everything and the Norwegian. Yeah, those are interesting, but they are approaching him in a way unlike they would with other people. I saw an article recently that was like, it was listing the hobbies of Elizabeth Warren and a few of the other female candidates. And it was making the point that we never do that. It's never like, you know, oh, Beto was in a band. Okay, well, Elizabeth Warren's been in stuff, but nobody's focused on that stuff with the female candidates. But with Beto and with Pete, it is weird how we focus on that.
It's not weird, it's America. I mean, someone else kind of pointed out, they put like side by side Julian Castro, mayor of a city with 1.5 residents, Harvard grad, HUD secretary, Pete Buttigieg, mayor of a city with 100,000 residents, vet, Harvard grad. Who does the media focus on? Why do you think that is? Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
I
Nobody's
guess.
Really questioning why America likes a slim, well-educated white man.
Yeah. And
with, like, what? No one needs questions.
That's true.
That. It's America.
I want to return just
we
quickly
do better,
to Tucker.
Though. Okay, unfortunately.
I don't want to speculate too much. We need to see how Tucker Carlson talks about Pete Buttigieg in the future, but it's noteworthy that he's like oddly sexualizing
that was
the
weird.
Interest in him.
Yeah.
And I don't think he does that. Like, he doesn't talk about Bernie Sanders in a sexual way,
right.
About slurping up every drop of a person. I can't tell yet if that's just a weird misfire at a joke or if it's some sort of weird, subtle homophobia. I'm honestly not sure.
No,
but we will see how he talks about it in the future. I will also note, though,
what?
That so the way that people are like sort of obsessively turning to Pete Buttigieg is interesting. But Tucker Carlson is on shaky ground to criticize that. Look at the way that Trump fans like Trump.
Yes.
It's not like, you know what? I like some of his policies, and so I guess I'll vote for him. They are obsessive about him and his family and his history
and
his business.
They wear t-shirts that say, he can grab me by the blank.
Yeah.
What?
That's the sexual, like, if you want to make fun of sexualization.
It's like very clear.
Exactly.
Right.
And for some reason, they're immune. It's totally cool. If right. you like Trump, you can be as weird about it as you want. But if you're in the meeting and talk about Pete Buttigieg, then he's got to talk
about it. He had nothing else to say, though. He had no serious criticism of this unnecessary, I think, popularity, and not saying that Pete Buttigieg shouldn't be talked about, mm-hmm. but why he's like the front runner and cover of the magazines and top of the conversation. He didn't have any serious criticism of that. He just mm-hmm. got weird.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, and I mean, that's his level. He maxed out at mm-hmm. intelligence.
So with Pete Buttigieg, I always feel a knee-jerk need to, when the media turns really quickly in favor of someone, I feel like I need to be willing to pump the brakes until there's justification for it. I've said I covered his first town hall. I thought he was good.
Yeah, I think he was very likable. I think I was here with you that day.
Yeah. But I'm also not willing to like sign my life over to him.
Right.
There's obviously other candidates that I support more. And I just think that I really do think that we are going to go through a cycle of this in this primary where Beto was the hot candidate, and then it's going to be Pete Buttigieg, and maybe they'll turn to Inslee, or maybe Kamala Harris will come back up on top. But I think that the media needs that sort of drama, that the storyline needs to have twists and turns as we go through the primary, or else people will get bored and they won't tune in. And so I expect that Pete Buttigieg, he's being boosted right now, and he's probably very happy about it. But I wouldn't get too used to that, because I don't think it's going to last.
There was a tweet that I saw early this morning, and it was someone had brought back Pete Buttigieg speaking in French, mm-hmm. and you know, giving his condolences to what's happening in Paris. And a quote tweet of it was, wow, maybe if Elizabeth Warren would talk about her policies in French, she'd get some attention.
Exactly.
And we were talking about that yesterday, how she has a lot of really, whether you like her or not, she has a lot of really solid policies, and she is doing what people say they want of presidential candidates, especially in the beginning. Yeah. They go surfing, you know, like searching through their websites, like where are her policies, where are this, where are that, and she kind of has everything.
Yeah.
And I mean, she has maxed out on policies so much, we're talking about public land.
Exactly.
Before an election, which is important.
Yeah.
But like, you know, all the hot topics, she's already, you know, like blown through them.
Exactly.
And she still doesn't get as much attention, which is fascinating.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's turn to a slightly different topic. The Time Top 100 Most Influential People is out. And as always, it is kind of frustrating because mm-hmm. I wasn't on it. And I really thought this time Brooke was going to submit me or something. No.
I should have. Who would write your piece? They need somebody famous.
If I was included in that, that would be a national tragedy. But anyway, the bigger issue right now is that some of the people who made it on the list are absurd. We're going to have a good one in a second, an inspirational one. But first, did you know that Brett Kavanaugh is one of the most influential people in the country? I mean, I guess objectively he's on the Supreme Court, you know, to the endless shame of the United States. But even worse was that the person who wrote about him for that list was Mitch McConnell, who said, when unhinged partisanship and special interests sought to distract the Senate from considering Brett Kavanaugh's qualifications, we saw other facets of Justice Kavanaugh's character shine forth as well. The country saw his resilience and commitment to public service. We saw his loyal devotion to family and friends. We saw his undeterred reverence for the law, for precedents, and for our nation's highest traditions. I saw a lot of things. I didn't see those things. And look at what he just did there. So these women coming forward bravely to talk about what they experienced, for Christine Blasey Ford to undergo a horrendous, torturous experience, that was unhinged partisanship and special interests seeking to distract from him. And when he sits and rants at people, red-faced and gulping water, and talking about these conspiracy theories about Hillary Clinton.
That's democracy.
That's undeterred reverence for the law, for precedents, and for our nation's highest traditions. Look, in his defense, conspiracy theorizing is one of the great traditions of America. Maybe he's right there. But, oh God, and for Mitch McConnell to write it too.
Like, aren't you busy? I don't know.
Shouldn't you be busy? Anyway, I don't want to end on that note. Okay. I want to end on a more positive note. Greta Thunberg, a 16-year-old from Sweden, who has organized students from around the world to fight for climate change. She is on the list as well. Emma Gonzalez, one of the Parkland activists, submitted her for it. And I just want to read a little bit about what she said about Greta Thunberg. So this is Emma Gonzalez saying, the civil rights movement leaders of the 1960s had no idea that school shooting survivors from one of the most southern points in the US would lean on their teachings to power a modern nonviolent movement to end gun violence. Students around the world began standing up for their survival, leaning only on the fire inside them to prevent the pain they understood too intimately. Greta Thunberg saw her power in us, and we in turn see our power in her. Fighting in her home country, Sweden, for a future free from pollution, environmental degradation, and climate change, Greta is inspiring steadfast students and shaming apathetic adults. She realized early on that the powers that would be stacked against her in her mission, stating, "We can't save the world by playing by the rules because the rules have to be changed." Greta went on to plan a multitude of student protests centered on action against our changing climate. Climate change is our reality, and youth activists like Greta are doing everything within their power to work against it and demand a change. And look, we can have this list where you have people like Brett Kavanaugh on the one hand, an ideologue, an obvious ideologue, who was put on the court to strip women of their rights, and Greta Thunberg, an activist who is fighting to stop climate change and organizing students to give a damn about their future. All on the same list.
Didn't the president of North Korea make the list one year or something like that? There's always people who don't influence the population positively, which is, I think, a big criticism of the list.
Yeah, but justifiable one. Anyway, frustrating. The Rock was on it, though. That's good.
You're so obsessed.
He's awesome. Come on, what are you going to do? Anyway, we're going to take a short break. We come back more on climate change after this. For more on climate change and what we could possibly do about it, we are now joined on the show by Michelle Romero, campaign and communication strategist for Green for All. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. And I'm looking to learn a lot here. So first of all, Green for All, could you tell us in the audience about that?
Yeah, Green for All was founded by Van Jones 10 years ago. And our mission is basically to build an inclusive green economy. We want to make sure that the people who are hit first and worst by pollution don't benefit last and least from the solutions as we transition to a clean energy economy.
And so your organization has had multiple campaigns, but now you have the Fuel Change campaign. What is that about?
We do, yeah. You know, a few years ago, we were really tackling power plant pollution, and now we're seeing that the transportation sector is the number one source of carbon emissions in the US. And so what we're doing with the Fuel Change campaign is giving people an opportunity to tackle climate change from where they live. We basically use music, art, and education to empower local leaders to bring 100% zero emission buses to their communities, to fight for investments in clean cars, trucks, and buses where they live, and to really make sure that we're prioritizing underserved neighborhoods and directly impacted communities.
So I think this morning saw something about overall prices for batteries for electric cars going down, making them more cost competitive with internal combustion engines. Do you feel like this is a time not only where it's important to get people to think more about the emissions from their transportation, but that people might actually be primed to listen to that message?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think the thing is, we know that cars, trucks, and buses are polluting low-income communities and communities of color the most. We know that these things cause asthma, cancer, missed school and work days, depression, you know, all sorts of health and human impacts today, not just 10 years from now, not 20 years from now, not the way that we think about climate change as something happening in the future, but that it's affecting people of color now. And so I think, you know, is there reception to tackling these issues? I think absolutely. I think, though, if we only talk about the climate crisis and what the federal government needs to do, then we are ignoring the fact that all of us really need to play a part. And there's so much that we can do locally and in our own states.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up, because we know that not only, so when you talk about climate change and the effects of climate change, obviously that is unequal in the way that it affects different communities, but also more traditional sort of pollution and all that doesn't affect all communities equally. So can you talk a little bit more about what impact there has been that the unequal nature of the damage done by these environmental threats, that certain communities are not talked about when talking about solutions, what damage that's done and how we can help to change the conversation around that?
Absolutely. Well, people of color are 50% more likely to live near busy roads. And so they're the most exposed to tailpipe emissions. When you think about communities like West Oakland, we're based in Oakland, California. You know, this is a community that's surrounded on all sides by busy freeways and highways. They've got diesel trucks idling through their neighborhoods all day long on the way to the port. And so the health equivalent for kids just playing in their own backyard is like smoking cigarettes all day long. And so that's what we're talking about. And that's, I think, you know, what we're trying to tackle here with fighting tailpipe emissions. We can actually transition to electric cars, electric buses, electric trucks. You know, these are technologies that we do have. What we need to do now is deploy them, not just in rich, affluent communities where you've got, you know, rich white dudes wanting to drive a Tesla, but in the communities that actually could benefit the most.
So overall, with this particular campaign, what would you say is the ultimate goal? What would you consider a success in this area?
Yeah, more work, more wealth, and more health for the communities that are the most impacted. We want to see charging stations in the hood, right? We want to see solar panels in the hood. We want to see electric ride shares in rural communities, and ultimately an increase in clean technology deployment where it's needed most.
I know that with the Green New Deal being one of the big topics of conversation politically across the country as we enter into this Democratic primary, are you confident, are you optimistic that not only environmental concerns will make it into questions in the debates, but also that the concerns of some of these underserved communities will finally be addressed on the national stage?
Yeah, you know, what I love about the Green New Deal is that for once it tackles not just the climate question, but the economic question and the justice question. It lays out a vision for an inclusive green economy that doesn't just solve the environmental issues, but that also is looking at how do we put people to work? You know, how do we uplift families economically? How do we also tackle the fact that, you know, environmental racism is a real thing and make sure that these things help everyone? And so I love that about the Green New Deal. And I hope that, you know, we can get to that vision at some point. What worries me about it is that so far it's a conversation that only the left is having. There's no entry point for conservatives. And I think that, you know, this is an issue that affects everyone. And if we're going to, you know, build an economy for everyone, we need everyone at the table. And so what I hope to see is that the politics aren't so polarizing that we can't get anything real passed in the coming years.
So for people watching this show, what can they do to get involved in this?
Yeah, well, go to greenforall.org. You can check out this new music video that we created that is featuring Black artists telling the story of the tailpipe emissions where they live. We're hosting watch parties in town halls and communities across the country. If you want to bring one to your area, you can sign up there. And we're providing toolkits and everything you need to get started. So check it out at greenforall.org.
Michelle Romero of Green for All, thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, more to get to. So I have good news and bad news for what you are able to get away with in America and still run for elected office. If you hypothetically were a 30 plus year old man and you tried to get with a bunch of 14, 15 and 16 year olds over and over and over, that will stop you from getting elected to the Senate once, briefly. And then you'll probably be able to do it on the next try. Right. Yeah, because Roy Moore is back, baby, and he might end up in the Senate. Roy Moore is the top choice of 27% of Alabama Republican voters for their upcoming Senate race. Three current sitting Republican congressmen who, as far as we know, have not tried to sleep with kids. Mo Brooks would take 18%, Bradley Byrne at 13, Gary Palmer at 11, and a few others down there. But right now, Roy Moore is dominating the field in this race. And of course, it's interesting that he's dominating, even though he's not in it yet. Now, he did say, I'm seriously considering it. I think that it, the 2017 Senate race, was stolen.
Can we stop there? That's disgusting. It's ridiculous. You lost. He wasn't taken off the ballot. Mm-hmm. He wasn't criminally charged. Nothing that should have happened to him really did, except for the fact that he lost fair and square. The race wasn't stolen just because a bunch of people who didn't support him went to the polls and cast their ballots.
Yeah.
That's absolutely absurd of him to say.
Mm-hmm. Like, there was a theft. He robbed the cradle, but other than that, there was no thieving in this. He barely lost after the sorts of scandals that
right. You
would think you'd be done. You'd drop out. You like, we got to get another candidate. Like, we got to get somebody so we have a chance. He narrowly lost, and he will probably win if he's the nominee. And because it's the Republican Party, and you can do whatever you want, he probably will be the nominee. So let's talk about his chances. The seat is currently held by Doug Jones, who won the last time around. It was obviously short term because special election, all that. Just 45% of those in Alabama say they approve of the job that he's doing. 40% say they would vote to reelect him. 50% say they would vote to replace him. Because after all, it's Alabama and he's a Democrat. And in terms of favorability of Roy Moore, a third say they have a favorable impression of Moore. 29% see him unfavorably. So it's not just that they'd be willing to vote for him. They are more likely to see him favorably. It didn't even really hurt him that much. Because the thing is, it seemed like once the allegations started coming out, that we were gonna have the sort of fight that we always have to have, where we have to convince people that the women aren't lying. Because in America, we just assume women lie about this
stuff.
But that's not what it was about. It wasn't like the Republicans all thought that the women were lying. Most of them didn't care if it was true.
They didn't care. They turned the narrative into these are fast tail girls. These are girls mm-hmm. who wanted that attention. These weren't young girls. These were girls who wore short shorts. And these girls wanted, they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
They did not care. And none of his supporters backed down. Just more people were furious about this across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And decided to go out and focus on people who should be voting. And all of those people still had the opportunity to vote for Roy Moore. They just didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was barely.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. And I think like he's talking about an election being stolen. Multiple women came out and said he stole their childhood and mm-hmm. stole their innocence. And he got away with it. And he is still brazen enough to be participating in interviews and this conference. Go away.
Yeah.
Like for your family's sake.
He's gonna go to DC.
It's ridiculous.
He's gonna end up in Senate. I mean, that's
you
what it looks
so?
Like at this
yeah.
point. Maybe if there's some sort of huge wave, if we have the exact right pick on the Democratic side and they're able to simulate out a lot of turnout, but it's probably gonna be pretty close regardless. And in a pretty close race, Doug Jones loses. That's the problem.
Great.
So while we would like to imagine that in America, the people who end up in the Senate and the House are the best of us, no, they're like worst, not even the worst of this generation, they're worst of a past generation, which is pretty bad too. And might end up in the Senate, actually. Okay, just briefly, I wanna mention something that happened. 60 doctors and other medical professionals have now been charged in a variety of different schemes to give out opioids in exchange for other drugs, sex, money, and things like that. When you first saw this, you surprised?
No. Mm-hmm. Because we all know that the pills aren't being created in bathtubs like mm-hmm. meth. Mm-hmm. They're coming from pill mills and doctors who are willing to, mark out the oath they took to do no harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, no.
So when I first saw this, my thought was, one, this is terrible, obviously. Right. A doctor is supposed to do no harm. Instead, they're trying to get laid by getting people addicted to opioids. That's terrible. But my second thought was, I was frustrated when this came out because I worry that this, like with the college admissions thing,
mm-hmm.
will get people to focus on the big scandal when the current system is the problem. Like, yes, 50 doctors doing this is terrible, but just doctors willy-nilly handing out these drugs, that's the issue. Even when they do it legally,
right.
they're inspiring people to get addicted to things that eventually are gonna get some of them killed. That's the problem. I don't want people to get too distracted by the criminal variety of it. Like with the college admissions, yes, some people are handing over $500,000 to get people into school, but a lot more people are simply getting in based on legacy, which never made any sense anyway. And so with the opioids, like obviously the new news is terrible. Those doctors, if they broke the law, they should go to jail. But we can't simply send them to jail and then, we're good. We fixed all the problems. We didn't fix all the problems. Pharmaceutical companies are still pushing these drugs on the doctors and giving them tons of financial incentives to prescribe them. The doctors are then pushing them on patients so that they can get more fancy lunches and money and all of that. And so even when no law is broken, it's certainly a violation of ethics in the best interests of the patients of these doctors. Okay, super fast. I just want to check to see if we have no more news.
It's
I don't think,
time.
But I want to see, because we haven't actually made time for this in a few days. So while I'm looking, you tell me something about yourself. On the spot.
Favorite color of clothing to wear okay. is black.
Okay, I like black too.
Every day I try to break myself out of that. There you go, interesting.
Okay, one of these says specifically not to read it on the air, but thank you anyway. Okay, so I'll end on there. Thank you for joining us with JR Sick. Thank you all for watching. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.